exposure and hepatitis actually falling into the serious disability definition so that we don't have to complicate matters? Would that be considered a serious disability because of the long-term consequences of those two infectious processes being resulting from a contaminated drug or device?
If I'm reading the Minnesota definition right, the answer is no. It wouldn't address them until you actually
got a loss of body function.
Yeah, until you develop, you know, dementia or something. It could be years down the road.
I guess we're going to talk about that later, but it strikes me that the simplest thing, in my mind, I would consider those two infectious processes, iatrogenic infectious processes, as being a serious disability, I guess. But that's just my opinion.
I'd be interested if that's come up in to hear from Diane, if that's come up in Minnesota, that particular issue in terms of a longer-term infectious disease complication.
Diane, are you still on the line?
Maybe she's muted.
Or maybe happens, had to hop off for a minute.
That happens to me a lot. I forget that the mute switch is on.
Right.
Well, I think we ought to get back to that issue, and perhaps we can do it, hopefully later when we do have a discussion around the definition of serious disability, we can bring that back up, because does anybody have, but just to do a quick, get a quick gut check of the group, does anyone have a difficulty with at least thinking about putting those significant iatrogenic infectious complications in the mix?
I think it's really important. Those are significant life-changing events that should be reportable.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Michael, I would say don't limit it to infection, because a catastrophic radiation overdose is going to come up too. There are a lot of things that change risk.
That would fall in a different category than this particular SRE, but I agree with that whole concept of things that change a patient's life permanently and often in a bad way.
Yeah, this is Cynthia. On this topic, as legal counsel for an organization, I would have no problem finding the actual contraction of HIV and or hepatitis as a result of a contaminated device to be a serious disability.
Does NQF have its own definition of serious disability?
It's Peter. We have, let me say it this way. We are hoping that we get a more clear definition of serious disability through the deliberations of this group.
Well, let's do this. I think that it seems that there is agreement that we ought to, under the rubric of this particular SRE, consider those events where someone contracts a significant increase in their risk or change in their life as a result of the contamination. What I would suggest is that we bring this up. Hopefully, Diane will be able to join us later in the call.
I am back. I had to step
up. You are back. Okay.
Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. So did you have a chance to hear the question that we raised?
I didn't. I knew if I stepped out for a minute, something would come up.
So the question came up around serious disability. And the notion here is that if a patient becomes infected with, for example, HIV or hepatitis, which could be life-changing and life-altering for them as a result of contaminated drugs, devices, or biologics provided by the healthcare facility, would you consider that a serious disability and therefore be considered as an SRE?
Oh, boy, that's a good one. I'm not sure if our definition captures that right now.
At least to our reading, it doesn't necessarily until such time as it gets to the point where it has an impact on your bodily function.
Right, and that's how I would interpret our definition as well, and that's not something that we've ever explicitly discussed. You know, our definitions have sort of evolved over time. Whenever an event comes up that we have questions about and we get together as a group and try and come up with clearer definitions, and they sort of evolve case by case. I don't think we've ever had a case that has raised those particular questions about increased risk over a lifetime or a change in lifestyle over a lifetime that doesn't quite meet that threshold of interfering with activities of daily living or bodily functions. So I don't think we do capture it right now. And I think it's a really great question for this group to discuss.
Perhaps we need to include additional care and or monitoring is required, some language like that, which is what you would do for some of these more indolent infections, but you're not disabled.
I think some of the pushback that we might get, I'm just thinking of discussions we've had around this issue in Minnesota, and this has been a thorny one, believe me. I think we might get some pushback related to whether the reporting facility would necessarily know about that need for ongoing monitoring later in life. Not that that necessarily means that's a reason not to include something like that in the definition, but there may be some difficulty in identifying it and reporting it after the patient leaves the facility.
Right, but there's generally agreed to performance guidelines for some of these, and which will evolve over time. But if you have hepatitis C, then there are criteria that we can turn to that says this is the monitoring requirement for that diagnosis.
Yep.
And perhaps we can craft some language that really reflects current standard of care as it relates to guidelines. And that is what is known to the facility at that moment. So if you get contaminated with, you know, a chemical that is, there's no monitoring, there's no guidelines, there's no obvious harm to the patient, you know, then that would not be captured, as opposed to a contaminant upon which current guidelines and standard of care includes additional care and or monitoring as per national guidelines.
I'm concerned that as it's currently written, it's too restrictive, and that unsafe events could continue to proliferate in the organization, such as the hepatitis C outbreak in Nevada. I mean, if you have to wait for somebody to develop cirrhosis when it might have been recognized that a single-use vial was used on a patient with hepatitis C, if you have to wait until that patient, exposed patient, develops cirrhosis, you know, the practices might persist. So I fear opening a can of worms with too much reporting, but I think that in ambulatory settings, over-reporting of this is not a problem.
I agree that I've gone to court with a fair number of these, not personally gone to court. I've been involved in cases, for example, of chemotherapy overdose, other chemical toxicities. You know, it's not contaminated, but where the issue is risk. And I think the suggestion of where some form of additional medical monitoring is imposed, a need is imposed by the risk. Maybe a useful way, I don't propose that we may be able to solve that language now, but if we take it offline, I kind of like that way of attacking, because that's kind of how the courts do it. There is a chicken and egg problem, but I think that it's promising for us if we say we know what the level of harm is. When the level of harm is so severe that the patient must undergo intrusive medical monitoring because of the imposition of a risk that they didn't bring with them to the setting originally.
And as long as we tie that to the discretion not being on the individual doctor, but related to national standards of care, some guidelines that are out there, then I think you'd be safe. Because people can be so disabled from a psychiatric perspective that they drive additional care. But that's outside of the scope of current standards.
Yeah, good point. Objective.
Yeah, I think that provides a little bit of a safeguard. I think the concern is how difficult this will be to interpret out in the field. But that I do think making it tying it to national guidelines, I think we'll fence it in a little bit.
Let's test it.
I agree. Without some such, I think we have ourselves a gap.
Peter, I think what this would require is I think we would need to have a very specific example that we make it clear what we mean by, you know, national guidelines and you know, altering a patient's life in a significant way. But I think it's going to require a bit more verbiage. I'm not sure it requires any change to the actual wording of the SRE. It's just an expansion of what we're considering as a serious disability.
So noted. I think that's an important point. Thank you.
Additional comments on that one? That's great. We can move on to death or serious disability associated with a device in patient care in which the device is used or functions other than as intended. Tejal and Eric, any comments?
So definitely relevant to the office practice. And the only thought here was sort of suggestion around wording to change to associated with the improper or inappropriate use of device in patient care. The question was whether this event was meant to capture device malfunction or improper and inappropriate use. Because they're sort of, you know, two different things in a lot of ways.
And from the skilled nursing tap, we thought this was very important to include. We have lots of people improvising devices for purposes other than they were intended. We also have people not trained to appropriately use devices as they were intended.
Hello, Michael. I would add a separate category for malfunction. And in support, I would point out that I've been asked by the FDA to design a taxonomy for malfunctions of electronic information systems. And, of course, the issue of whether it's an innate system malfunction or user error is always going to be in front of us. But, again, here where those are two different things, I would really try to separate them.
I agree.
So that would involve essentially splitting this, because right now it does say devices used or functions other than as intended. So functions other than as intended would capture the malfunctions. Explain to me why you think it's important to separate out the two of them.
I'm not going to fall on my sword over that. And if people feel as though we should comprehend them both, then that just means we need to make sure that it's clear that we mean user either because of a user choice decision or error or an inherent attribute of the device.
It seems, this is Phil Schneider, that first of all, there's a lot of these SREs, so I would argue, unless there's compelling reasons to do otherwise, to not splitting out and increasing the number of them. Secondly, it seems like the events are focusing around a treatment process rather than a human performance issue. So we're focusing on a contaminated drug, for example, and a device. So we're focusing on the intervention of care, the form of care, rather than the, and there could be human factors issues that apply to all of them. So I think the way we've these events have evolved focuses on an intervention. So I'm kind of inclined to keep it the same. That would be, I'd cast my vote for that.
My comment is not about splitting, but about the issue of serious disability or death. If you have a staple gun that misfires and you have leakage around an anastomosis of a vessel, and that requires a much larger procedure than was intended and a heroic measure in the OR to save that patient, and they walk out of the hospital without death or serious disability, I think we would want to know that. And right now, the way this is the same exact line of thinking as what we just went through with the contamination, because you had to perform additional measures above and beyond what the planned and intended procedure was. And somehow, I think we should capture that.
This is Sally. I have a question for you all on how things actually happen in the in a healthcare setting. When a device used as intended, just as a question about how people know how something is intended, I assume when a device is patented, that definition gets codified or whatever. So you're sent that, you sent some verbiage on it, and when you first purchase the device, maybe you get a demo from a manufacturer's rep, but is that the way anybody should know exactly what the intended use of a device?
Well, I think that, this is Hazel, that raises the issue. Our group also discussed about off-label use, because especially in pediatric settings, for example, there were comments about, you know, devices that may not be necessarily approved for pediatric settings that are used all over the place in pediatric settings, and so would that, the group felt those should not be included as, you know, functioning other than as intended, because, you know, the clinicians are intending to use it, but it's just an off-label use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Diane. That's an issue we've struggled with here, too. When you talk about how it was intended to be used, is it how the provider intended to use it, or is it how the manufacturer intended for the device to be used? And that hasn't been entirely clear.
Michael, I would support ignoring the labeling and let the judgment of the clinician govern.
And I think there's always going to be operator error. So as far as the ambiguity over that, as to whether my example of the staple gun misfiring, somehow we'll have to have clarity over the fact that, in fact, it was a device malfunction as opposed to operator error, which would then go potentially more to a peer review perspective, that they didn't know what they were doing with a staple gun that was working well. But when the determination is made at the facility that, in fact, that staple gun was not working correctly, that would need to be reported if additional resources had to be implemented to save that person.
Yeah, and in our definition, we do exclude those individual practitioner technique issues. We say if you were using a device for a purpose or in a manner for which it was intended to be used, but individual practitioner technique resulted in a serious outcome to the patient, we don't report those.
Right.
So, this is Michael. I think part of the argument here for keeping them all melded together is like the Toyota accelerator. I think it could be years sometimes before you know whether it's the device or the operator. And throwing away the reports for all the time until you're sure might be a sacrifice you don't want to make. So I guess my argument would be to collect the data on something that seems to be a malfunction or misuse and let the root cause analysis sort the chips.
So would you then, if my staple gun went, and that case was looked at, and it was deemed to be an operator error after internal peer review and investigation, would you then say that we would not report that, or we would report all? And because the RCA is going to happen independently of the reporting.
Well, I get involved in these a lot with software, and the argument you get into is, for example, you have a screen that's impossible to read, and someone reads it wrong, and they do something. Then the user sues the user blames the vendor because it's a stupidly designed system that no user can use properly because it's just unusable. And then the vendor blames the user and says, "You just need more training." And because we get into these and they're really insoluble, I see many cases where the surgeon throws the thing across the room and says, "I always hate those things. I just can't get my hand around it. It never works. I don't have the strength. Badly designed." And the vendor says, "Well, you're just a bad operator."
Well, that I kind of had what you just raised. I have a question with Diane because you said your definition in Minnesota, you leave out individual practitioner technique, I guess. And what is, I mean, you know, if a practitioner says, "Yeah, this doesn't fit my hand very well, so I'm going to jerry-rig something that feels more comfortable to me," yet that actually does then impact the functioning of the device.
Yeah, and I don't think we've really gotten to that level of detail. You know, every time we revise or tweak a definition, new cases could potentially come up that we that are still gray, and that is one of them. The reason we added that exclusion was because we were running into cases where it was clearly not the situation you described, but a situation where it was just the provider's technique. We had catheters that were inserted incorrectly and caused harm. We had tubes that were inserted incorrectly, and it was a peer review issue, and we were really hearing from our facilities that they didn't feel that they were reportable adverse events, and we felt that their rationale for referring them to peer review made sense because it wasn't indicative of a larger system breakdown. It was that individual provider's technique, and so we wanted to exclude those. But yeah, there's certainly a continuum there too between just not knowing how to use a particular device and making a change to it that changes its function or its effectiveness.
Yeah. We've had a couple of cases recently of Da Vinci robotic techniques, robotic surgery techniques, where a surgeon spent, in one case, 13 hours doing a procedure that should have taken 5 or 6. And the peer review issue there was, well, this guy had no business trying to use that device. But we're seeing enough of these suits about this kind of thing that we wonder whether the institution, that the system breakdown in the institution is, why are you idiots letting these idiots operate on people when they can't use the machine, which happens to have a tremendously long learning curve because it's a horribly difficult machine.
We really want to be careful about stepping into that, I think. I mean, I think we've got to be separating clearly peer review issues and OPP, FPP requirements from Joint Commission, which really is what you're, I think, getting at, to the need to report if a device clearly malfunctions. We send out a lot of devices for independent review at our health system when these issues come out, you know, ECRI or other, you know, labs to independently confirm whether a device has failed or not. I think whatever we do, we can't make this ambiguous. It sounds like there's a lot of ambiguity to what we're talking about here. I mean, it has to be a clear device failure, almost independently tested somehow. I mean, I don't know if there's enough resources to do that for all failures, but I mean, that's got to be like for sure. When independent testing has deemed that the device has failed, that certainly needs to be a no-brainer. Then you get into a lot murkier levels.
which I don't know if we can sort out at this time.
Aren't these events driven by the clinical consequences as opposed to the underlying cause? In other words, if there's a death or serious disability, it's associated with these devices. I guess fundamentally that should be reportable regardless of whether it's a human error or a device design error. Are we focusing more on trying to capture the events at the point of proximal to the event such that the clinical outcomes are what drives it and the association with whatever event we're talking about, in this case devices, is that what we're trying to do? Otherwise, we're going to wait a long time before the event's actually reported.
That's my point. I appreciate the difficulty about not wanting to get involved in peer review, but in aviation, it's very common for the question for any plane crash to begin being called pilot error, and sometimes it's years before somebody realizes that this plane is just not flyable the way they built it. And I would say, again, like with the Toyota accelerator, even before we know ultimately the answer, we should not throw away the data. Or we should want to be more inclusive at collecting rather than less. I realize that's a philosophical question.
This is Tejal. I agree with that as well. You know, I think even when it goes to peer review, there's often process issues associated around training and supervision and those kinds of things. So I wouldn't necessarily want to pull those out.
Well, and then we would have to change this to patient death or disability associated with the use of a device. Period. If we broaden it, which I think is just too broad. I think it's got to be narrower. I think we can keep it narrow by clearly stating that the device malfunctioned. And I would love to see the idea of additional resources here. Because that patient, you might be in a great health system that can save somebody, you know, from death or serious disability because you're able to see a complication and quickly mitigate, you know, that the effect of that complication. But other health systems may not be so able to do that, and that patient may die.
Yeah, this is Cynthia. I guess the only question I have is whether or not whomever these events are being reported, and in most cases it's the state, wants to know about all those device malfunctions which currently would be reported either to the manufacturer or the FDA, but are not necessarily reported to the state. And I actually think that kind of report might be valuable, and then therefore the suggested change to the definition a moment ago would cause that to be and otherwise leave it as is, which I think works fine, at least in my experience.
Because the FDA doesn't care about death or disability, correct? FDA will take the expanded definition. If you're concerned, you submit a report.
Right, so the FDA would be broader, but we would say that for it to be a serious reportable event, that it ought to be a death or disability.
I think that from the NQF standpoint, it's good to make what I'm calling the reporting threshold high, death or whatever we end up calling injury or harm. And so that means it wouldn't be any bad outcome associated with a device. We just need, I think it's doable to just add one more clause that says that the event description is a device is either there's three subsets. The device seems to malfunction itself. The device is clearly misused or misapplied for its proper use, or we can't tell. And the threshold for reporting is it causes serious injury.
At what point does that how are you defining injury, I guess, is the question.
Well, that goes to the discussion we deferred.
Yeah, so I think it would be back to the death or serious disability.
Yeah. To which I would incorporate risk, but, you know, I think we can do that. We're already on the pathway of doing something like that. So, for example, let's take the Cedars-Sinai CAT scan brain frying experience. I hope we'd all agree that we want to know about that. You go into a CAT scan, you come out with your forehead on fire, and it's because you got a huge overdose of radiation. Now, was that the device or was it the operator? Well, it actually was an interaction. And yet the injury here is, well, they didn't die or were seriously disabled, but they now have the they walked away with a really different risk category. So to me, that should be something that we would capture right in this one, you know, if we just phrase it right.
So you really are expanding it then, which I agree to.
Does anyone have a strong objection to expanding at this point? So hearing none, then we'll try to incorporate that language and we will we'll send it out to the group for comment for the SurveyMonkey. Any other comments on the devices? Hearing none, then let's move on to Air Embolus.
This is Eric with the Skilled Tap. We thought that this was an appropriate addition. We know that there are activities going on in the nursing home right now, and if this reporting would help the facilities get to the concept of bundles that we now see in hospitals, that would be a very worthwhile approach.
And from the physician offices, we did not think it was relevant to our setting.
Any further discussion?
This is Diane. Just a question. I'm recalling from one of our in-person meeting last fall that there was some discussion around the exclusions for this category and whether the exclusions related to neurosurgical procedures still apply at this point. And I am absolutely no expert in the field of neurosurgery, so I would leave that to others, but just wanted to remind us that had come up as a topic of discussion when we met last fall.
Is there any group that we should reach out to here? No one has a comment who's on the line today, but is there any group that we should reach out to on that?
Well, it doesn't look like we've dealt with this suggested modification one here, which is even more than neurosurgery. It looks like we have ECMO, pediatric neurosurgery and pediatric heart surgery.
For those who are following on the webinar, if you could just pull back up those comments, the exclusion comments, that would be helpful. Great. Thanks.
This is Michael. I don't want to talk too much here. I'm getting overexposed, but I have a problem with trying to exclude things simply because under today's state of the art, they're common. Because it seems to me one way to ensure they remain common is to make them invisible from reporting. And then there are a lot of things that we thought used to be inevitable risks of a procedure that we've been able to reduce or eliminate because people found out that they were very common and they started trying to remediate them. So if we just say, oh, well, we're not going to make people report on things because they're so common, we just live with that and let people have air embolisms because, oh, yeah, you know, it happens. If we believe that reporting is prejudicial and blameful and that it's shameful to report, then, yeah, any institution would want to not report something, have a immunity from reporting it because it just happens all the time in their institution. But to me, that seems to be the wrong path.
So the recommendation of the NQF staff was that we don't make any change here. So that would mean including these events, and yes, we'd hear about them more, but I think that point is well taken. Does anyone feel strongly that we ought to have those exclusions?
The exclusions are the neurosurgical procedures?
The neurosurgical procedure exclusion is in there currently. The suggestion was that congenital heart conditions and ECMO those be excluded in addition.
Well, I still think it would be good to get some feedback about the neurosurgery one as well, because no change would imply we're keeping that one, and I don't know for sure either what the risk is, but if we're kind of saying we shouldn't include
neurosurgery, so another technical expert who could help us on that.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're going with the concept of, you know, we shouldn't assume these things are not preventable, then, you know, ECMO versus neurosurgery, it may, you know, we should probably have the same philosophy. But there must be, I don't know if, like, there's a neurosurgical society, I'm sure there is, but some group out there that could help us understand that.
I do think there is a reporting burden on hospitals too, you know, children's hospitals that do these. You know, if every one of these you see, it's very common, then there may not be. I mean, I just want to be sensitive to the resources to make sure we're reporting the right stuff.
Yeah, this is Helen. The American Academy of Neurologic Surgeons are NQF members. We'd be happy to follow up with them if it's something you'd like their input on.
That would be terrific. And I think just to Doron's last comment, we still are talking about, death or serious disability. So I guess I would say that there's a reporting burden there, but these are significant events.
Yeah, I was going to say again, looking at the driver on this is the clinical outcome. I'm a little uncomfortable with having exclusions and having people look at this as how can we get excluded from this if there's death and serious disability. The aim should be to try to reduce or minimize or eliminate that based on evolution of techniques and our knowledge. So as a general rule, unless there's compelling reasons to do otherwise, I kind of agree with the discomfort of having exclusions in our SRE list.
So the follow-up here is we will follow up with the suggestion that Helen had about getting a subject matter expert to at least opine about why we should consider continuing with the current exclusion, and we will hold on adding further exclusions for now. Does anyone have any objections to that, to following that path? Any other comments on air embolism? Okay. Patient protection. So the first one is infant discharge to the wrong person. An infant is defined as less than 1 year old. Comments on this?
So in the office setting, we did not think it was relevant to our setting. There was a long discussion about issues around custody and knowing who the true person is and that the infant should go to and this and that, but bottom line was we felt it wasn't relevant in the intent of the SRE.
And from the skilled CAP, we do have children in some facilities, but we also took this one on by saying, gee, we've got impaired and incapacitated people who are just as at risk, and a second item might be appropriate to identify them differently so that we don't put them into a category of children, that we actually identify that there is another population just as at risk as young minors.
This is Michael again with a contrarian opinion. Daycare facilities are usually criticized roundly when they send a kid home with a kidnapper. And so even though in ambulatory facilities, I think, yeah, the opportunity for kidnapping and being negligent about where children go who are in your custody is a much greater risk. I again have a queasiness about giving immunity from reporting for something that is basically fairly rare, but for the victim is enormously important. And again, here I would say the criteria is not death or serious disability, because that doesn't happen usually. The reporting criteria here for me would be if the child is left in your care and you're not careful about who you give it to afterward, I think we should know how often that happens.
This is Cynthia. I appreciate the confusion with the term wrong person, but I would object to the change of to unauthorized person. Because of the many legal questions that arise, particularly with respect to custody disputes, which a medical facility may not have the ability to unravel during the short stay of the patient with them.
Tejal, do you want to say anything further about why you didn't feel, your TAP didn't feel it was applicable?
Well, I think, you know, it related a lot to the custody issues in the, you know, somebody brings the child and, you know, a different person comes to, well, first of all, we thought the scenario was pretty rare because usually when people come with their child, they stay. And then, you know, if somebody else comes and the child leaves with them, you know, I think they felt like clinics are not necessarily in a position to be, you know, verifying for, and I think it's more in the situation, again, for like a teenager or something like that, verifying that that's the right person, because I think they felt that mostly for younger children, the parent stays with the child in the ambulatory setting for pretty much any scenario. So, you know, for toddlers and so on.
This is Debbie. I'm back on, and I think didn't we have a discussion about infant versus everyone else, including infants, at our first meeting? As was suggested already on the call, that restricting this sort of event just to infants, while it maybe they shouldn't all be in the same SRE, but it might be too limiting when others are incapacitated as well. I mean, what's infant? Define infant. Is it under one? Are we using a...
Yeah, infant is defined as under one.
Under one.
We did discuss that when we met, and it seemed at the time that it didn't really make sense to arbitrarily say under one when